go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Ben Bolin.
And I'm Scott Benjamin.
Hey, Scott. How's it going?
Not too shabby.
What do you think about buckboards?
Two words. Love them. I really do. I think these are so cool. This is something that I saw recently when I went to a museum here in Georgia.
Uh-huh.
And I was fascinated by it.
Ah, but when we say buckboard, we should specify that we are talking about buckboard cars.
Yes, that's right. Because buckboard, if you think, I mean, there's going to be a segment of people out there that will hear the word buckboard and automatically think of something else. Mm-hmm. They're going to think of a carriage or an old wagon from, you know, late part of the 19th century. Buckboards came about, and buckboards were really it's like the front part of a carriage or a wagon that protected the driver from being kicked by the horse.
Right, or it was also a footrest.
Oh, yeah, footrest too. That's right, because it has – if you think about it this way, think about a wagon, think about like the front part of it. You know, it's either a curved piece of wood or a flat piece of wood. Very low. It's only about a foot high maybe in some cases. And it had, you know, the holder for the reins for the horse. And it's really just a part of the bigger wagon, really. But a buck, that's what a buckboard is. It's just that one piece of the wagon. And that term then got kind of turned around into what we call buckboard cars.
Ah, yes. And you can still see examples of buckboard wagons today, not just in museums. Some Amish communities use buckboard wagons.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
We want to just give you that sense of history, and now we're going to jump into the thing that we think, no offense, buckboard wagons, is way more interesting.
Yeah.
The buckboard car.
Well, you know, the buckboard wagons were really, you know how we've talked about this several times.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the early cars, I mean, the very first cars, and they were nothing more than a horse wagon that was turned into a vehicle with a motor.
Yeah.
So that's what this is, really.
Sometimes with an electric engine.
Sometimes, yeah. That's right. That's kind of the exciting part about this is that, you know, they went back and forth between the two technologies.
Let me tell you a story about a guy named Charles Metz. Do you want to hear it?
Let me hear it.
All right. Charles Metz founded Waltham Manufacturing Company in 1893. And this was, of course, in Waltham, Massachusetts. So first he was building these things that he called safety bicycles.
Mm-hmm.
He actually started building something called the Orient.
Oh, safety. You know what? Real quick. Yeah. Safety bicycles. So those were the first bicycles that had the same size wheels, right?
I believe so.
The ones that had the same size wheel in the front and back, because before they were those really goofy looking ones with the huge wheel on the front and the tiny one on the back. Yeah, okay.
The steering wheel
on
the back.
All right. I'm sorry. Got distracted.
So the first car that has the name Orient, the brand, is a small electric roadster. But then he started doing something a little bit different. In 1903, he debuted a little thing called the buckboard. Now, when we say little, we mean little. Scott, could you describe what a buckboard looks like?
Yeah, you know, you say little, but it was long.
It was long.
But little. It was small in height, I guess.
Yeah. Short, maybe, is a better word.
Okay, I've seen one of these. I've seen a 1903 buckboard. And this is the vehicle that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
These are few and far between. I saw it at a museum, and this is probably where you're going to see most of them. I mean, you may see them brought out for special occasions, parades, things like that. But a 1903 Orient buckboard is on display at the Tellus Museum in Cartersville, Georgia. And you can go see one right there. I've walked around this thing. I was just fascinated by it. It's a wooden car, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wooden car. I'll describe it the best way I can.
Okay.
You're sitting on a series of planks that run lengthwise.
That's your suspension, too.
Yeah, that's the crazy part. There's no suspension. Okay, we'll get into that in a second.
I'm
getting beyond this, but it's basically a series of wooden planks that have a couple of seats bolted to them. And a steering wheel that pops up at a funny angle from the front wheels.
Mm-hmm.
The wheels are almost like bicycle tires.
Yes.
They're wooden, of course, or sometimes they're metal spoke, but in this case, I believe they were wooden. Kind of small. They're not quite bicycle tires. They're wider than bicycle tires. They're smaller than newer bicycle tires.
Yeah.
There's a difference. And there's an engine at the back. That it's gear-driven, I believe, in the Orient case, but we'll talk about another version later that's kind of interesting. This is a gear-driven vehicle, and it has a couple of speeds, so there's a real, real primitive transmission, like a two-speed transmission. But you're sitting in a vehicle without any frame, any bodywork around you.
Right.
The frame is wooden. Everything about it is wooden except for the mechanical bits.
Yeah.
It's just such a strange vehicle. I mean, I couldn't stop staring at this thing.
And these things can go on the order of 20, 25 miles an hour.
Yeah, yeah.
Which doesn't sound that fast until you realize how close you are to the ground and the fact that there is no protection whatsoever.
True. You know, and if you've ever been in a go-kart.
Perfect.
20 or 25 miles an hour, that seems like you're going 100 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
It feels so much faster when you've got all that wind blowing in your face and there's a lot of sensory input and you're that low to the ground. But I guess more so than that, you know, this is just, it's an automobile at its most base form. I mean, it's the absolute essentials and nothing more.
Right. The Orient Buckboard seated two passengers. It cost a little bit north of $400. Now, of course, this adjusted for inflation would be much higher, but let's...
$400. Okay. In 1903?
Yeah.
That's probably pretty expensive.
But let's keep in mind, it's still the lowest price auto at the time.
Oh, very good.
Which is a very big advantage. Now, I'm going to startle you with some stats about the four-horsepower beast.
Please do.
That the engine was.
Please do.
Yeah, four-horsepower, two-speed transmission. This car, check this out, Scott, weighs 500 pounds.
That's it. 500 pounds.
That means that if you got one person and each corner of the vehicle, you could pick it up and carry it.
That is really cool. I like that.
And let's see. It had, as we said, almost no bodywork at all. It had a range of about 100 miles, and this wasn't a car that people were using to drive across the country.
Yeah.
This was a car for maybe a middle-class family who really wanted a vehicle but couldn't afford the more high-end, luxury, custom-made coaches that people were selling.
Yeah.
And in a way, this really... I guess, level the playing field for customers.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? I could see that. I mean, in farm communities, I think this is a big vehicle.
Right.
The picture that's on display with the vehicle that's on display at the Telus, I think, if I'm not mixing up two images that I've seen recently, I believe that the image that's there is of, you know, a gentleman and a lady that are in the vehicle together, dressed very well, out on a farm somewhere. They're on the grass driving this car. You know, it's like it's just kind of used for maybe on their own property, something to get from here to there. Maybe the occasional trip into town, because at the time you could do stuff like that. You could drive whatever you had into town. I mean, you're riding a horse into town if you wanted to, or, you know, a horse carriage. You know, in the early days of automobile, something like this would fly on the road. I mean, something you could get away with this, and really there was no one there to hassle you about it. Now, not so much the case. Oh, one quick thing.
Yes.
You mentioned that there's no suspension in these cars, right?
Yes.
So you'd think it would be terribly uncomfortable to ride in, but it's probably not.
No, it's not, because the way that the seats are situated on this plank, and you guys, literally, it is just like a series of planks.
Yeah.
There is maybe... a little bit of a strut, a little strut work, but it's purposely built so that there's some give on these planks. I don't know why I'm making hand motions.
Well, no, that's fine. I mean, if you picture, like, okay, the you know, for our listeners in the north or in colder sections, they may think of like those sleds that have the red rails. You know,
good point.
But that's the way the planks look. They run that long distance, and you can't do something like this on a flat piece of plywood, because it doesn't have the same amount of give as if you put it on individual smaller planks that are thinner. They have a flex. There's a flex to them. And I was thinking about this morning on the way into work.
Mm-hmm.
What other vehicle do you know of, Ben? This is a pop quiz, and you may or may not get this. What other vehicle do you know of that doesn't have any suspension at all?
That doesn't have any suspension at all.
Zero suspension, but relies on body flex in order not so much comfort in this case, but for functionality.
I give up. I think I'm going to know it when you say it.
You will. You know those Top Fuel dragsters?
Oh.
The ones that are 20 feet long, 21 feet long, whatever they are?
Yeah.
those have no suspension either, but they rely on the flex in the frame, the frame mm-hmm. itself, in order for, and it's not for driver comfort in that case. In that case, it's for performance because, you know, it needs a certain amount of flex, otherwise it'll just snap itself apart.
Right.
These vehicles, now, I mean, you can picture it. You can kind of see how, like, maybe, you know, you're going up and down bumps. Mm-hmm. I'm bumping up and down in my chair right now.
Yeah.
But you know, you're going over rough terrain, you can see how those planks would flex and give way a little bit in order to make it a more comfortable ride. And that's all they're relying on. I mean, it's the most simple form of transportation you can think of, really, motorized transportation.
I bet it could still be a little bit startling if you're going 25 miles an hour and you apply the brakes.
Yeah, I would think so.
We need to talk about those brakes.
Yeah, please do.
So the brakes are fairly simple. Some people may say distressingly simple.
I'll say primitive.
Okay, primitive, yeah. If you wish. So this primitive braking system has a handle, and when this handle is pulled, now this isn't on every car, and we're about to talk about some different buckboard cars in a second. When it's pulled, the covering over the wheels.
Sure, the fender.
The fender, yes, thank you. The fender is pulled against the tire. So it's not like a disc brake or a drum brake. It is literally the fender being pushed onto the moving wheels to slow down the vehicle.
So it's a friction brake.
It's a friction brake that has got to get pretty expensive on wheels over time.
It's like you should just maybe heave a block of wood out of the car and let it get in front of the wheel, and that'd be better.
I knew a guy when I was growing up who had a go-kart, and his way of stopping the go-kart was jumping out.
Dragging his foot or something. Oh, jumping out.
He would just jump out, do a little roll. It didn't go very fast.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah, it must not have gone very fast. Now, in this case, I wouldn't want to let my buckboard car get away from me.
No, you wouldn't.
You know, even though they're cheap, they still were, you know, that was sometimes, in some cases, your daily transportation.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? Here's the thing. It wasn't just Orient that was making these things.
Excellent point.
You know, later, you know, these are early on. We're talking 1902 to 1908. They made mm-hmm. all these variations of buckboard cars. Well, if you look at an Orient buckboard car compared to what we're going to talk about next,
mm-hmm.
that was high class. That was over the top, extreme. It had all kinds of bells and whistles compared
right.
to what we're going to talk about next, because there were some simple versions of buckboard cars. And this is what initially got me interested in these. Actually, I think even before, because I had seen these before, and I just didn't know what to call them. I'd seen them before I saw the Orient at the Telus Museum.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of got it sparked, I guess. But something called the Smith Flyer.
Yes, from the A.O. Smith Company in Milwaukee.
Exactly. Now, that's the first company that made them. And we're going to quickly go through this because mm-hmm. there's a chain of about four different companies that own the rights to what we call the Smith Flyer. And just real brief description of this. This is a much, much smaller version of mm-hmm. a buckboard car. This is more along the lines of go-kart size.
The seats are like little half stools.
Yeah, I love the seats in this thing.
Yeah.
It's like little tiny, almost like bucket seats, like those custom bucket seats you'd see in vans
yeah.
and stuff.
Yeah.
Only they're really, really small, like maybe just a few inches tall.
Mm-hmm.
Padded, of course, and you sit right on the planks on the bottom of the vehicle.
Yes.
It's the most simple vehicle you can imagine. Just take a look at, you know, for a Smith Flyer online, you'll see what we're talking about. And the crazy thing about this is it's got a little tiny engine at the back that's mm-hmm. attached to a wheel.
A fifth wheel.
That's right. So this has got it's a direct drive motor wheel,
mm-hmm.
but it's a friction system. So you raise and lower the fifth wheel with a handle lever
mm-hmm.
in order to either slow or stop the vehicle or, you know, full speed, whatever you want to do. But you raise and lower this thing. And this was, you know, initially applied to, I think, to bicycles.
Yes.
You know, kind of like a moped type setup, you mm-hmm. know, what we call moped now, but a motorized bicycle. Tiny little fuel tank on top of this engine. This is the craziest thing. I've just never seen anything like this with this fifth wheel where you raise and lower the thing in order to get it to go. I can imagine that, you know, there's a lot of wear on that back wheel when you're
yeah.
raising and lowering it because it probably spins. Because it's full speed ahead, I would assume.
Right, yeah. So you have the engine started and you wait till the engine's running smoothly. Then mm-hmm. you take the lever and you gently lay it down. I think this is one of those things where a lot of the finesse is key.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just drop this thing down because these cars are so light that I wouldn't be surprised if applying all the force at once would make the car buck, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe the front end would pop up on you or something.
There's something about these cars, Ben, that reminds me of a toboggan. A motorized toboggan. Like you're on a toboggan on wheels on the road.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's just the layout of the wood, the planking and just the overall look of it. But it reminds me of sledding. It's the colors used, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The red.
Yes.
And the color of wood there's something about it that reminds me of sledding. But anyways, let's move on that engine, Ben, it required an engine to run. So mm-hmm. it makes sense that, you know, after a decent run of this thing from the A.O. Smith Company,
mm-hmm.
and it was called the Smith Flyer, from 1915 to 1919, and around 1919, they sold the rights to Briggs & Stratton, which makes perfect sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because Briggs & Stratton, an engine manufacturer, but they were getting into, actually, they were just getting into the business. So, you know, Briggs & Stratton, brand new at the time. Stephen Briggs, an electrical engineer. Then there's Harold Stratton, who was a grain merchant, Ben. He wasn't even a grain merchant. But together, they formed Briggs & Stratton, and that company is still around, of course. You can find some information about them on their own website, including a shot of Briggs & Stratton in a Briggs & Stratton Flyer. Because, you know, they have the rights to it. So they've got there's a picture of a close-up of the engine, you know, that they used to power this thing. But anyways, they were getting into this new thing, these new car things that were happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a smart move for them, I think. So, you know, now you got something called the Briggs & Stratton Flyer. All right. And they held on to that until about 1925. So that's about 6 years of this car production. Of course, you know, they kept doing their engine production up until, today. They sold it to a company, and this is where it gets a little bit even more interesting, Ben, a company called Automotive Electric Service Company in New Jersey.
Okay.
So here we go.
Here we go.
Service Company. Now, what do you think they're going to do with the diminutive Smith Flyer, or the formerly Smith Flyer, now the Briggs & Stratton Smith Flyer, or Briggs & Stratton Flyer?
Well, they probably want to consolidate it with something they already make, mm-hmm. which would be an electric motor.
Exactly. So these things became electrified in around 1925. Now, I think they sold out the original, whatever they had left in stock of the motor powered. So you could still get an Automotive Electric Service Company vehicle that was powered by a motor to a point.
Okay.
Then they began producing electric vehicles. And the cool thing about these, Ben, is that, you know, they're so small, they're so fun, and people kind of really like them.
Yeah.
You know, not only for personal transportation on your own property or, you know, just getting in, you know, to and from town, resorts started picking up on these things.
I can see that.
And, you know, guests on, like, let's say you go to Atlantic City. And you stay in some, highfalutin resort out there on the coast,
uh-huh.
and you need a way to get around on the grounds, the property. What better way to do that than to rent your own little vehicle for two? You can imagine, you know, the ladies all dressed up with a camisole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And is that the right word? Did I just say something
dirty? Parasol.
Parasol. Boy, did I say camisole?
Yes.
That's lingerie.
Oh.
That'd be totally different, wouldn't it?
I mean, I was going to let it go. I was going to treat it like the Pope sweat thing.
Let's say parasol. How about a parasol instead? Okay, so they've got the parasols, the sun umbrella. That's what I meant.
Oh, wait, 1 second, though. If we hadn't pointed this out, one of our listeners would have thought, they don't know. We do know what camisoles are.
They would have said, what kind of resort are they staying at? No, okay, especially in we're talking about the 1920s, so that was not the case. But you can imagine,
sure.
you know, the dress of the day, but imagine, you know, someone tooling around on the grounds of some, giant estate,
mm-hmm.
In one of these vehicles. Once you see these vehicles, you'll understand what I mean.
Very similar to the way golf carts are used in resorts now.
Exactly. And, you know, electric power, you bring it back at the end of the day, they charge them up and they're ready to go the next day. They might have a whole fleet of these things. It's not just doing a one or two.
Mm-hmm.
They may have a whole series of these things that they can loan out to people to just cruise up and down the shore all day long.
And they're probably all painted red.
I would guess so, yeah, because, one of the things that they called these things was the automotive red bug, or the red bug, I think
mm-hmm.
is what they called them.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still find red bugs. The thing is, they're boy, Ben, you know, one time these were the cheapest automobile. Actually, you know what? They're in the Guinness Book of World Records.
Yeah, they still hold the record. Sorry, Tata Nano. They still hold the record as the cheapest car of all time. Being Guinness Book of World Records, I'm sure they say something like the most thrifty or
Yeah, you know what? I'll tell you, it's the most inexpensive car of all time. and it ranged between $125 to $150 brand new.
The price is right, huh?
Brand new. So you could buy these things, you know, for $125, and you know, the thing is now, Ben, if you want to find an auto red bug, mm-hmm. which is what they call them red bugs. That's kind of a general term now for them. I'm looking at an example of one here. These were actually manufactured in Lafayette, Indiana, the Red Bug specific. Mm-hmm. A 1920 Red Bug is going for $10,000.
Wow.
And it doesn't even say that it's really road ready, if you want to call it that, because you're not going to be able to drive it on the road anyways.
But, right. Right.
It says it wouldn't take much to make this thing, you know, drivable, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But again, single cylinder engine. Braking is really just pushing the fenders against the rear wheels, you know, that type of thing. Two horsepower, single cylinder. Red Bugs, these are produced from about 1914 until, I'm going to say, 1930, Ben, and there's a twist on this.
Which is interesting because you told me this off the air. Conventionally, people believe that these cars, this type of car even, not just the Red Bug, but this type of car in general, really diminished and lost ground and ultimately disappeared in the 20s, but you found something that says that might not be the case.
Yeah, the crazy thing about this is if you dig a little bit deeper into this, you find that in March of 1930, there was a report that said that the Indian Motorcycle Company in Springfield, Massachusetts, might be building these things on a kind of you order one, we'll build one,
mm-hmm.
that type of situation. And, you know, really, there's not a whole lot more to it than that, you know, that maybe these things existed until about 1930, because the Indian Motorcycle Company did buy the rights to the Auto Red Bug, or they own the Auto Red Bug at a certain point. Again, 1930 is kind of the end of these things. The problem was, Ben, and you know this, why the small type vehicles like this, these inexpensive vehicles, eventually went away, right?
Yes. Mr. Henry Ford.
Yeah, that's right.
A clever individual and BFF of Thomas Edison, as I learned recently, who decided to institute the assembly line. He was able to mass produce vehicles eventually at such a pace that the price lowered.
Yeah.
And cycle cars, or excuse me, the buckboard cars were no longer as competitive as they were.
Yeah, because they had gone up in price because, you know, they'd become more popular.
Mm-hmm.
There's relatively low production numbers.
Right.
The price of them had slowly crept up over the years from 1902 all the way up until like the 1920s, let's mm-hmm. say the mid-1920s. And they got to the point where it was cheaper to buy maybe a used Model T than it was to buy a buckboard car. And why wouldn't you buy a used Model T?
Right.
Because you've got body work, you've got actual brakes.
You got a windshield.
You got a windshield.
There's a roof.
Yeah, exactly. There's just a lot more going for a Model T than there was a buckboard car at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. I think it's kind of cool. I mean, I really like the buckboard design. I just love looking at them. I think they're a neat vehicle. I think it'd be fun to have one in your garage just as a weekend toy. You couldn't drive it anywhere, though.
Well, I've got some good news for you.
What's that?
Well, not great news because you still can't drive it on the interstate.
Yeah.
But you'll recall in magazines such as Popular Mechanics or the Boy Scout magazine, Boy's Life, these vehicles were sold in ads, right? Of very similar vehicles, at least, as DIY car kits. And even today, there are some similar device. Now, these are not, of course, the authentic turn-of-the-century Orients that you're looking at, but you can find and order plans to build your own similar system.
Oh, very cool. I got to say, though, I have seen some of the newer vehicles. I've looked at, you know, in fact, there's another one here in Georgia.
Yeah.
There's the Microcar Museum that's in, I think it's in Madison, Georgia.
Oh, yeah. Post-World War II, these vehicles reappear.
Yeah.
And they're known as microcars.
Microcars, bubble cars, but those have bodies and windshields and, you know, all the...
tiny, tiny windshields.
Yeah, tiny, tiny windshields and even smaller windshield wipers.
Yeah.
But, you know, they did emerge as different types of vehicles. Now, buckboard cars, which were all wide open and wooden frame construction and all that.
Yes.
No suspension. There are some examples of these into the 1960s. And, you know, there's an example of this in this microcar museum that's in Madison, Georgia. Bruce Wiener, I'm not sure how you say his name. There's a 1960 McDonough buckboard vehicle that was sold through Sears or J.C. Whitney. And, you know, you could buy it through other catalogs, I guess. But these were kind of, you know, the catalogs of the day that people would order everything from houses to, to, you know, other types of goods that you need around the house, tools, things
Sears
like that.
And Roebuck catalog.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. You know, the story with that. They could order everything. Well, including these buckboard cars. And, all the way through 1960, you could do that. Again, do it yourself, like Popular Mechanics, Popular Science. I'm sure that you can still find kits, like you said today. But, you know, if you want the true thing, the true deal, you're going to spend upwards of $10,000 to get something that's, you know, reasonable shape, that you could even drive around your neighborhood.
And if you don't want to spend $10,000, I would be glad to point out you can see some excellent videos about this, on your favorite video streaming site, and you can check them out at, museums.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's just plenty of museums that have these things. And that's a crazy thing is that, you know, there's maybe, I don't know, just a couple hundred left of these things around that, you know, are true authentic versions. But there's a lot of, you know, remanufactured type vehicles that, you know, they start with one single piece and they build them up to, you know, make an entire car out of them.
That's kind of funny.
A Franken car.
Yeah, we have to mention that. Franken car is a good word for it. So as we were looking into this episode, we were researching on various forums, and there are quite a few people who may have the aim of restoring one of these, and quite frankly, don't have very many parts.
Yeah, they may have a handful of parts, but you need, you know, a truckload of parts to build one.
And it's so cool that you can actually do that with these cars.
Yeah,
you know, if all you have of a 1950s Cadillac or something is a wheel, then no offense, man, but you're out of luck.
Yeah, you're building a car. You're not strictly restoring a car, right?
And
we talked about the difference between this earlier because it's kind of funny. Like, you know, the parts that some people are looking for are pretty major.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for the planking, or I'm looking for the motor.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of a big deal.
But
it's hard to find.
But yeah, so more power to these folks because you can actually do that with a buckboard car. We would love to see some of them. And that brings me to a question, Scott. Instead of doing listener mail, do you want to do stuff Scott sees?
I do. And you know what? I've got some stuff laid out here in front of you, and we talked about this. I've got a 1-2 choice for Ben. I've got one marked with one marked with two.
Ooh,
and this is a blind test for Ben here. You choose one, and that's what we'll talk about today. And the next one I'll save for the next episode because these are equally good. I didn't know which one to go with.
All right. Number two.
Number two. Okay, so let's see what we've got here behind number two. Oh, Ben, you have selected this. And I'll give you the picture, and you know what? I'll share this with listeners on our Facebook or whatever.
Oh, wow.
That, Ben, is a Dodge Charger, a modern Dodge Charger.
Yeah.
With 30-inch rims.
30-inch. Okay, I was going to ask how big they are.
This was spotted here in Roswell, Georgia. That's where I live, Roswell, Georgia. And I saw this, and I'll be honest. When I went by, I did a double take. I kind of laughed to myself. And I thought, no, I was seeing things. I had my kid in the car with me.
Mm-hmm.
I said, no way. I went to the next street. I turned around. I came back. It's parked at a local barbecue restaurant.
Oh, okay.
I snapped this photo just through my car window. I pulled into the parking lot and had to take a photo of this thing.
Is it for sale?
It is not for sale. Oh. That sign in the window says at 30s wheels or at 30s world.
Oh, okay.
Which means there's a lot of cars out there with 30-inch rims like this. Now, this car, to me, this looked, I thought my mind was playing tricks on me. This car looks photoshopped.
That's what I was going to say. This photo itself looks as though somebody went through and just zoomed in and enlarged the wheels.
It's almost like wagon wheels on this thing.
It is.
It's absolutely crazy. Look at the sidewalls on those tires. Those are tiny, tiny sidewalls. If you hit a bump with those, you're going to bend those rims.
So I
don't know. I don't know what to think about this. I mean, I was actually laughing quite a bit, and I thought, well, that's kind of a cool customization. Look at all the bodywork that has to go into this thing in order to make those 30-inch wheels work. Like, imagine turning. Like, where does all that wheel go in the front when you turn to the left or right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's incredible.
I think we should get 30-inch rims on our cars.
I laugh at this, but someone's really serious about this. It just took a lot of effort to put these on this vehicle, and can I just be honest, Ben?
Just be honest.
It looks ridiculous. To me, it looks ridiculous. Other people may love this look. They may think that this is what they want to do with their car. So I don't have any prejudice either way to say, go ahead and do it. I think it's fine. I'm just saying, it was so unusual that it actually made me stop. This is in busy traffic. I had to turn around, come back, roll down my window, take a photo. I did stare at it for a while, and then I left.
You can at least respect from an engineering perspective the technical skill.
That's exactly my point, is that someone really took a lot of effort in doing this to their vehicle. This is a serious customization. It's not just something simple. You don't just go somewhere and order these to be put on. It doesn't work that way. The wheel wells themselves, there's a lot of body work that goes into this. And I'm gonna share this photo online, on Facebook maybe.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I don't know. I'd love to know what listeners think about this, but it was like my eyes were fooling me, and I had to turn around and see it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, check out our Facebook, guys, and tell us what you think about these rims. Also, tell us what you think about rims in general. Do you have some on your car? Do you have monster rims, or do you have more reasonable?
How about bigger than 30-inch?
Yeah, do you have 32-inch rims? it's funny because for a while in hip-hop, there were there was this sort of escalation of rims, bragging about rims, by which I mean one person would be bragging about how they had 30-inch rims, and the next song would come out and someone would talk about how they have 32-inch rims.
Yeah, but you know what? As far as I remember, now this is why this caught my attention. We were talking like 20s first,
yes.
22, mm-hmm. and then if you got up to 24, that was really excessive. Those were big.
Right.
Take a look at these 30s and you tell me what you think.
It really does look like Photoshop, guys.
It does.
And while you're on the internet, why not drop us a line, let us know what you think about rims, about microcars, about buckboard cars. You can say hello to us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. We would love to see local pictures of ridiculous cars in your town, and you can email us directly at
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.